Good morning, and thank you for joining me on another episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I have an exciting show for you today. One of the reasons I know it's so exciting is because our first guest has been on this show 562 million times. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm completely kidding. But you will recognize her face. You will recognize her name. And most importantly, I think by now, you're going to start to recognize her brand. And that's what we do here. We talk about our businesses, our life, and what we do. But before I bring her on, I'm going to ask you to do what I always ask you to do. And that's to make me some new friends. Yes, go out and make Sharifa Hardy new friends, because I want to be friends with all of your friends. And the only way that I can do that is for you to share me with them. That's right. Friends don't let friends miss out on the Roundtable Talk Show. And while you're sharing me with your friends, I'm going to introduce my friend, Allison Allman, and her business. She is the organizational maven. I messed that up, Allison. Like, first thing in the morning, I can't even say organizational. You forgive me?
I forgive you this time.
Not next time, though.
Not next time.
Are you going to come back?
Oh, yeah. I'll probably be back in a month.
I'll show up for my spot right next to you.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Did you bring me hot wings or pizza? Nothing this time? Nothing. Nothing.
I've stopped the junk food. The quarantine 19 has left the building. I'm working on getting it down, the number.
How are you? How are you? One of the things I loved about your social media recently is that you're like me, and I don't know what everybody else on the panel believes, but Alice and I love to talk about astrology, because we'll be like, that's the Aries thing. That's the Aries way. We love that Aries energy, which we are, but it's like we go in cycles, right? It's like all of a sudden it's quiet, and then it's like all these Facebook posts, and you were a little quiet, and then you start talking about your networking, and then all of a sudden you were like, deal closed, deal closed, deal closed, deal. I'm like, go, Allison. Make that money. What have you been up to lately?
I've been back at work since May 5th. I'm a home organizer that specializes in garage organizing. I'm known as the Organization Maven, and I'm here in Southern California. I specialize in garages because I noticed there's a big need for it. I do still organize closets and kitchens and whatnot, but most people are now turning their garages into home gyms. So there's been a sudden influx of people looking for garage organizers. So I've been out doing consultations and meeting new people and still networking. And so it's been really great seeing the shift that people, I guess, are more accepting of being home. Or maybe the need that they, you know, don't want to go out to a gym because of social distancing and wearing a mask, which is great for me because people's garages are full. And so it's my job to organize it and make their dream come true of having it be a home gym or a home space outside of the rest of their family, like their escape room, or I wouldn't call it really a man cave, just people are escaping to their garages to get away from the people in the house.
That's news to me. I didn't know that. I didn't even know that. Like, that's interesting to me. Like, that's a whole psychological, and you know what happens? It's like, now that you've mentioned that, every show from now on, I have to be like, did you escape in the garage to get away from your family? Like, I need to know these things. I didn't even know you had shifted to focus on garages.
It happened about a month ago where I realized that I wanted to stand out from all the other home organizers. I did like a Google search and I saw that there was like 488 home organizers in Orange County. And wow. But then when I Googled garage organization, the only thing that popped up was those companies that remake garages, like the epoxy floors, the cabinets. There's no organizers specializing in garage organization. So then I tweaked on my SEO words and a lot of my branding information to include the garage organization so that I can pop up first after those companies that make over garages. So it's great that if you want to do an epoxy floor, but you have to see your floor in order to do the epoxy. So you need someone to come in and organize and get everything out so that you can do that. So I wanted to come up as the first search without having to do AdWords. So I just tweaked my branding, been talking about it more. I linked up with Houzz, H-O-U-Z-Z, and I now have a branding person working for me, where I, on the landing page for Houzz, my my pictures are starting to be added to their general loop of projects. And then there's some video things in the works with Houzz that to help, same thing on Houzz. There's a million home organizers in Orange County. None of them specialize in garage organizing. I don't know why. So I saw the need, you know, I just was looking for ways for me to stand out and be picked more often, or if people are Googling or going on to different websites. And then with being picked more, when I go out to consultations, I'm asking, why suddenly do you want to organize your garage? Oh, I want to do a home gym. Oh, I want to escape. Oh, I want my kids to do homeschool out here. You know, all these different reasons are popping up. So that's just helping me get more work and be different. And I can still do social distancing as long as they're in the house. Then I'm outside in their garage working. And so it's just been a new marketing idea that kind of just happened over the course of the last month. Since last time I saw you, it changed.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. You have to come back every month. Like, I need you here as, you know, a permanent seat.
I can tell you what's trending.
Right. Like, and here's Allison. Yes. You gave us a lot of information. You gave us what you did step by step over the last month to pivot and to redirect your business. And if people didn't take anything else from what you said, key in on the keywords and how you mentioned the SEO and how you tweaked your SEO. That sentence alone was a gold mine that I do not want anyone to miss. Please give that to us again, Allison, because you understand what I'm saying. Like, people may have glossed over what you just said, but I want to explain this to people. You literally took your business in a new direction by rewriting the content and the meta tags and the metadata on your website so that Google is now finding you for more keywords, correct?
Right.
So I want to make sure we focus on that.
The problem is a lot of us small businesses that are doing our own marketing is we choose words that are too vague or too big or too broad. So that's where the SEO specialists come in and say, hey, I'm going to charge you $8,000 and I'm going to do the words that are tailored to your company, but I don't know anything about you, but I'm going to charge this money. So I just went through and looked. I Googled myself and I Googled, you know, where there was a need of. So like I said, when I typed in home organizers for Orange County, you know, 488 showed up. And I was like probably on the eighth page on Google search, and no one goes past the first five. I mean, just no one, rare, unless you're looking for something unique, you'll go to page two. But for the most part, you just look at that first page, you call people, you're done. So I just thought, okay, there's no garage organizers. Let's just start changing my keywords and on my website to match garage organization so that it can't, so I can be picked. I want to be picked. I don't want to be on page seven because no one, I mean, only people that go to page six are the celebrities.
So I love it. I think that's wonderful. That's why I always enjoy having you here on the show, because we always learn so much. And it also allows me the opportunity to follow your journey. I definitely have more questions for you. I want to go over to our next guest, Ms. Carla Bass. And she is interesting because she's the author of Right to Influence. And one of the terms that has been kicked around these days in the last 10 years or maybe 5 years is this term influencer. Right? Everyone wants an influencer for their company. Everyone wants to be an influencer if they are a company or a figurehead. So I want to discuss this with Carla. Good morning, Carla. How are you?
Good. I'm fine. Thank you for having me on your show.
You are welcome. Thank you for joining me. Is it my imagination, or is this influencer word more relevant in today than it ever has before? Or maybe we just called it by another name. Maybe we just knew that celebrities sold things. They sold books, they sold content, they sold products.
Anytime you are communicating with anybody, you are trying to influence. Mm-hmm. So what I focus on is empowering people, teaching them how to write or communicate better so that their message is more concise, precise, focused, and effective. Mm-hmm. And the title for the book, Right to Influence, is precisely that. I learned this. I spent 30 years active duty in the Air Force, and throughout my career, powerful writing was central to my success. I learned firsthand that powerful writing changes lives. I was a squadron commander at one point, responsible for 480 wonderful young men and women, but it was the most losing unit in the island in statewide quarterly and professional and annual awards, because the supervisors could not tell the stories of what their subordinates had accomplished. So I taught them how to write. We became the unit to beat, and I ended up teaching my methodology for the next 15 years to thousands of people in the Air Force. So I transformed all that to apply to businesses and corporations and academia and NGOs. And that's what Right to Influence is all about. It empowers you through the strength of your own written word if you just know how to craft the message.
What are some tips? What are some strategies? What are some guidelines that we should keep in mind if we want to write to influence?
The first thing is you have to know that every communicator is constrained by two things. You're constrained by time because everybody is busy, and you're constrained by space. You only have so much opportunity, whether it's the above the fold space on a web page, or if you're limited to 400 words or whatever. So the first thing is recognize that precision is paramount. The second tip is to outline your message. Given the fact that you are limited, what are the key points that you want to get across in what order? So I call that don't bury the golden nugget. Express first what is the most important, and then put the backup and the ancillary information following that. And then I have word sculpting tools. This is where you go through your draft, and sentence by sentence, you eliminate the redundancies, the wasted words, the words that hog space, so that you make sure that every single piece of that opportunity you leverage to your advantage.
Okay, you gave us some gold there, Carla. And again, like...
Is it true that we're not supposed to use the word but in our vocabulary because it usually means something negative or it's a wasteful word?
No, I use but. It's the same thing as however. I mean, if you're into space-constrained writing, though, but is better because it has fewer letters than however. And it's not negative. It's a pivot point in a thought. That doesn't mean it's negative. But the beauty, I was thinking about your garage spaces there. You're teaching people how to overhaul garage spaces and maximize that. I'm doing the same thing. I'm teaching people how to overhaul their means of communication and maximize the space and the opportunity that they have to convey that message. And this is so important for resumes, for input to performance reports, for marketing products, for attracting really talented employees. You have to know how to pitch your case. And there's a psychology you have to know, and this applies to all of you. You have to know what is it that the consumer wants. You pitch your message from their perspective. How will overhauling their garage benefit them? How will they benefit from my book? How can I help change your life? And here is how. So that's it's empathy. You have to pitch it from the consumer's perspective.
I like that. That was a great answer. And it reminded me, it gave me a memory there, which was kind of interesting because, you know, back as a kid, one of my first jobs out of high school was working for TWA, for Trans World Airlines. And then I evolved. I sat on the customer service supervisor desk. And all of my coworkers, whenever they heard me say, however, they would go, oh, here she goes. Like, that was my work. We handled all these irate people. And they would be like, you lost my luggage. And I would be like, I understand. We lost your luggage. It's gone. However, you will have to come in and retrieve it because we're not going to deliver it to you. And it's like, I always, you know, yes, I understand. I understand that we just destroyed all of your, you know, your wedding dress and your bag. However, because you signed that disclaimer, we will not be able to, you know, reimburse you for it. So yes, those are great words. One of the things that I don't want to gloss over in what you said, Carla, is the use of the word above the fold. For our viewers or our listeners who aren't sure of what above the fold really means, because you're giving us gold, and I like to make sure people notice the gold. What is above the fold, Carla?
Well, above the fold is the area on a web page that actually shows on your screen. Similar to Allison explaining how people will not go through page 4, page 5, page 6 of Google searches, very often people will not scroll down to the bottom of your web page. So the information that they first see, that's the golden space. That's where you want to get the message across, is the top part of that web page, because they may not hit that downward button and look at what's underneath it. So if you bury the gold nugget down there, you've just harmed yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I always tell people, when we think of stores and we think of real estate, what do you say about real estate? The most important thing is location, location, location.
Yeah.
When you think of a website, location, 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 and your prime real estate is above the fold. Yes, interesting. Yep. We're going to have a lot more conversation, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest. And this lady is amazing, but I tell you, I have this story. Her services I had once, and I was so scared. So I definitely want to learn more. She's going to talk to us about not only her business, but the art of threading. Good morning to Sumitra Batra. Good morning, Sumitra. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
I got to learn about the art of threading because I only had it once and I was like so scared. Like, why did you introduce it? Why do you love the art of threading?
The art of threading is an Eastern art form of hair removal that uses a piece of thread that is then twisted, and it removes the hair from the follicle. The twisted part actually grabs the hair and we remove it from the follicle. It is a very prevalent street art form in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And our company Ziba Beauty brought it to the United States 33 years ago. Mm-hmm. We used to live in Long Beach. And we used to come to Artesia, where Little India sits, and we used to come to get our groceries and just sort of like get a little bit of a cultural experience for us. Mm-hmm. We used to come here when my mom lost her job, she decided to go ahead and open up a salon. Mm-hmm. That specialized in threading and Indian Eastern services like mehndi and threading. And that's how we basically started the business.
Yes, but you don't just have one salon.
No. It is 33 years later. I am now, she's retired. Although she's retired and coming to this building every day now, since COVID. And we, pre-COVID, had 14 studios, 120 employees, servicing about 45,000 customers a month.
Amazing. Some companies would love to get 45,000 customers in a year. Yes. or 2 years, you know. Yes. So it's amazing that, I mean, sometimes I'm amazed by some things that are considered like the simplest thing. Okay, you get some thread, you remove the hair, and this is a multi-billion dollar industry. But I was amazed because, like I said, the first time, I always have my eyebrows waxed, right? Like, that's my thing. Like, I get them waxed. I need a wax now, but forgive me, it's a quarantine. But someone introduced it and they're like, you gotta get your eyebrows threaded. And I was like, threaded? What is threaded? Like, I hadn't even heard of the term. And so they were like, you gotta go. It's like so cool because it's an experience. Like, you have all these ladies that are around you, and then you do, at least at this place, and I don't remember the company name, forgive me, but like they did facials, and it was like almost like an experience. And I thought it was just so interesting. But I found that the threading gave me a cleaner line than when I used the wax. Was that my imagination?
No, with waxing, you have to wait for the hair to be a certain length for the wax to actually grab the hair and pull it out of the follicle. Mm-hmm. With threading, the artist has a lot of control. We can grab the hair sometimes just before it's about to pop out. Mm-hmm. And or, you know, it doesn't have to be very long. We can take out a whole line at a time, or we can take a single hair out at a time. Whereas with waxing, it's linear. You know, you just have to put the strip. So with the reason a lot of people prefer threading over waxing is because you really can get the absolute most beautiful shape possible for every brow. Everybody's brows are different. They suit you to your face, and we're able to have control. So we're able to give you the best possible shape for your eyebrows with threading. Mm-hmm. And you don't have a lot of this, and you also don't have a lot of the, with waxing, you are exfoliating the, you're actually removing the top layer of our skin is always dead skin. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people get rashes and irritations with waxing that they don't get with threading. It's just a mild exfoliation. So yeah, that's why people prefer it.
When I get my eyebrows waxed, I look sunburned because they pull off all the skin. So then I look sunburned around my eyebrows and it looks really creepy for a while.
So with threading, you'll get just a little bit of, with threading, you just get a little bit of redness because it's almost like scrubbing your face. It's a mild exfoliation versus, it's a little bit more extreme. Waxing, we do waxing, but the waxing is more recommended for your body than for your face.
That's good to know.
During the COVID time, we all don't have a choice. Usually I would never be a proponent of waxing your face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've done threading before, but it was probably about 10 years ago when I was introduced to it. I forget where I was. I think I was getting my nails done or something. And then they're like, hey, we got to wait for your nails to dry. Let's go thread your eyebrows. And I go, okay. Blonde eyebrows, you can't even see them, but okay.
It's funny how you get introduced to different things, but it's just all interesting to me. And I love learning. And it's a certain sex appeal to a lot of different things with the industry. For instance, henna art, right? You're a henna artist. Whereas people will say, oh, that tattoo, don't get that tattoo. Like, don't do that to your body. But then you see henna art and it's like, oh my God, that is so beautiful. Especially henna art at a wedding when everybody, oh, I just love it. You're a henna artist as well, Samita.
Yes, I'm a published author with a book called The Art of Mendi, published by Penguin, Viking and Carlton Books. Mm-hmm. It's had a second edition. Henna is another street art form from Southeast Asia, very prevalent in India and Pakistan. We use it. It's considered to bring you good luck and good fortune. Mm-hmm. And it is a form of celebration. Henna is a plant and its extract, when ground and applied on skin, leaves a tattoo effect, which is anywhere from a bright orange to a deep burgundy that lasts anywhere from 10 days to 3 weeks. So it's sort of like a temporary tattoo. If you break up with your boyfriend, you're not married to the married to the tattoo.
Interesting. That's funny. So that's, you know, because sometimes we have these certain beliefs. Like, is it one of those where you get your boyfriend name and it lasts 2 days? That's not a good sign. Like, it washed away. That means this is going to be a short relationship.
Well, actually, when we get married, there is a saying that the darker the color, the more the bride is loved by her mm-hmm. her mother-in-law. And you know, when you really start to think and look deeper into a statement, you know, you can find where the truth is coming from. Today, henna is done in the form of like a mini cake decorating tube. Mm-hmm. And so we fill it up, and that's our medium. Mm-hmm. But in the olden times, they used to make the paste almost toothpaste consistency, and they would sort of like, you know how if you put something pasty in your hand and you get like a little point when you do this. Yes. They used to kind of do this, draw a line. And it would take like, you know, we paint, it was our traditional jewelry really, you know, mm-hmm. It was very ironic because it's the great unifier. Okay. In a country where racism or a caste system is very, very prevalent. A Hindu's daughter and a Muslim's daughter, a rich person's daughter and a poor person's daughter, everybody, when they get married, they get their henna. They get their hands decorated with henna. So it's a great equalizer. It has broken all castes and all religious barriers. And it's just the great equalizer. And with henna, what they used to do is they used to take a long time. So a woman or a bride that had the patience of getting that henna done and stay with it overnight, which gives you the depth of color, really actually had a lot of patience. And when you're in a joint family and you have a lot of patience, of course your mother-in-law is going to love you. Mm-hmm. You're a very patient person. So, you know, the messaging has a reason, it has a origination, and most of us don't take the time to truly look at why is this being said. You know, mm-hmm. The early bird gets the worm. You know, it's because there's a lot more worms out there in the morning, and by the afternoon everybody's been sort of like they've had their meal, you know. Yes. So there is a meaning to it if you study it. So with henna, it's supposed to bring you good luck and good fortune. That good luck and good fortune was associated with you know, it was a form of celebration. We do it before we have a child. We do it before we're getting married. We do it during festivals. Mm-hmm. And so those are considered things that are good in your life. Mm-hmm. And so it got associated with celebration and good luck and good fortune. So I am a
artist,
but I used to do henna. Mm-hmm. But with the amount of work and everything that I had to do, now I'm much more of a creative artistic director. I guide because I've kind of developed somewhat of a carpal tunnel.
I like the analogy about the good fortune in the mother-in-law, because like you said, there's more to it. Like the early bird gets the worm, is because with patience, if she's impatient and halfway through or a quarter way through, she gets up, I'm not doing this, I'm mad, forget this, then the mother-in-law automatically knows how she's going to respond and react to certain circumstances. Whether she's going to
respond like that. That is how she will respond. You know, personality shows. So obviously no one, whether it's mother-in-law, brother-in-law, husband, no one's going to, you know, I think you love the people that give you the most patience. You know?
Oh, that is beautiful. I'm taking a lot of little nuggets from today's show, but I definitely want to go hop on ocean.
I saw that the white henna was trending before COVID. I don't know. I start watching something on Facebook and then like 8 videos later, other things pop up. And so somehow I got added to the white henna list. Did you notice that before? And is there any kind of back, like why did the white henna come out? Explain that.
Henna in its natural form is only it's a green herb that releases an orange dye, orange to deep burgundy dye. So that is natural henna. The United States and the Western world wants color, and so that's body art. And so there is a difference. They call it henna, but it really isn't henna. Henna in its natural form only releases one color. There is no such thing as black, purple, red. White henna,
because I saw like people getting like their wedding, they had their wedding dress on and then they were doing all the intricate designs, but the ink was white, and I was like, where'd they get that? What plant did that come from?
Actually, I was one of the first people to do that. I was hired by for a photo shoot for Pantene, and the model was wearing a white bridal dress, and I just didn't feel that the henna in its original form would go with the shoot. So I decided to do use white body paint and paint henna designs on her so that it would match the dress. With us, our colors, when we get married, our colors are bright. I mean, our wedding dress is red, you know?
I'm gonna need one of those
colors. And so the orange and the burgundy kind of goes with those colors, whereas with white it can stand out, and not everybody wants that. So a lot of people are just interpreting and creating almost like, you know, you get earrings to match. It is an accessory after all. And so people are just sort of, it's their interpretation, what they're attracted to.
I think that's wonderful. I think that's beautiful. I think it has a lot of history. You know what I mean? I love history and I love learning the history behind certain things. Now, I definitely want to introduce our next guest, Reverend Stephanie. And I think Reverend Stephanie's bio is just amazing. She has like 20 different hats. She doesn't have any of the hats on now, but she has 20 different hats. She's just a metaphysical woman. She does healing. She does so much. Good morning, Reverend Stephanie. How are you?
Good morning, Sharifa. Thanks for having me on the show.
You are so welcome. Tell people a little bit, just a little bit about some of the things that you do.
Okay, but first, before I do that, I just want to say thank you, Sumita, for your lovely talk on henna. And as I was listening to you, I had an awareness that I hadn't had before, and I want to share that. In June last year, I was in Egypt with Reverend Michael Beckwith from the Agape community in LA. He was my ministerial school teacher, and I hadn't seen him for many years, and I joined this trip to Egypt with him. And on that trip, I met my husband, who I'm now married to.
Oh, wow.
He was a member of that group. And about the second or third day of the trip, we went to a little Nubian village to visit the temple of Ramses II. It's called Abu Simbel. And in the Nubian village, the ladies were doing henna designs, and all of the American guests were able to get their hands hennaed. So I had my hand hennaed, little knowing, and I didn't make the connection till today that I had already met my husband-to-be and didn't even know it. And within a few days of having my hand hennaed, we sat and talked together. And after that conversation, that first long conversation of about 2 or 3 hours, I went back to my hotel room and I thought, oh, this is the man I'm going to marry. I'm going to spend the rest of my life. And so now I'm seeing the henna as a forerunner of a wedding. Didn't even connect before. Anyway, so now a long intro that has nothing to do with anything.
But that's what we do here. No, it has something to do, is because one of the things that I've learned, and I began to see patterns in each of the show, is that I thought in my you know, human mind that I had 5 different guests, right? But I began to see so many similarities. I began to see so many different connections. Like when Sumita was talking, she kept referring back to what Allison was saying, or Carla. It's like we're all connected. We're all one. And it's just beautiful to have a platform to be able to share these connections.
It is, yeah. So Allison, my husband and I were just talking the other day about converting our garage to a gym. So thank you for that. And Carla.
Where are you located, Reverend Stephanie?
We live in Medford, Oregon.
Okay. Well, I don't know if Allison travels. I was just trying to get you a Southern California run, but it's okay. How did you get, you talked about Reverend Michael Beckwith, you talked about Agape, your husband. How did you get into the metaphysical?
Well, I was beginning to develop spiritually in my early 20s. I lived in Amsterdam at that point, and I was busy training to be a hippie, and I never really succeeded. I'm a failed hippie, but I got into esoteric stuff, and I studied astrology and psychic healing and everything I could study that was non-academic. I come from an academic background, and in Amsterdam, I just rebelled and I studied whatever I could that was different, that was spiritual. I grew up in a very alcoholic, dysfunctional family, a lot of pain, and I couldn't wait to leave home and find the meaning of life. So as soon as I got to Amsterdam, I just delved. And meanwhile, my mother got divorced from my father and moved to South Africa. And I judged her harshly for becoming a colonial in South Africa. And I wasn't speaking to her, just decided to cut her out because of her politics and her racist point of view. And then she invited me to come and visit her in South Africa. And I booked a 2-month trip. And I really thought, I'm just going to go for 2 months. I'm going to hate the system. I'm going to hate everything about South African politics. This was the mid 1980s, 1985. So apartheid was still in full swing at that point. So I thought I'd hate it. But the first night I got to South Africa and I had a really bad headache, and I decided that I would meditate to try and get some relief from this headache of mine. And while I was meditating, I heard my inner voice say to me, "I've brought you here, and now it's time to get on with the work." And I didn't know really what that meant, except that I had the feeling that I had to fix apartheid single-handed. I was a little grandiose at the time. So soon after that, I discovered the First Church of Religious Science, which is a metaphysical church. Now the name for that church is Centers for Spiritual Living, so it's changed its name. Nothing to do with Scientology. Does have some connections with Christian Science, but so the main tenet of the teaching is that your thoughts create your reality. That's the bottom line. So we're all responsible for what we create in our lives. Anyway, I joined the classes, and very soon I got the inner guidance that I needed to go to California to train to be a minister in the teaching. And I had a big vision at the time. I had a big vision for a multiracial ministry. Now, in South Africa at the time, it's hard to even imagine or believe. I think everyone here is from America. I know you're from India, Sumita, but in South Africa, really, under apartheid, the division was extreme. It was schizophrenic. So we would go to our white church, and we wouldn't have any black members in the congregation. But the teaching is about oneness. It's about how we're all united, how we're all one in spirit. And the South Africans couldn't see the massive discrepancy between the teaching and what they were actually living in the society. But I had come from outside, so I could see it. I could see the hypocrisy in that. And my vision was to have a multiracial ministry in South Africa that would move towards healing the big division of apartheid. At the time that I had that vision, it was illegal. It was illegal for whites and blacks to meet together. So whenever I met with my black friends and black students, I was teaching English to some I was teaching English as a volunteer to some black domestic workers in a little private school that was set up by a friend of mine. But meeting with them was illegal. So I could have been jailed just for teaching a class to these black domestic workers. So at the time it was an illegal vision. But I went to America in 1989, and I started at another ministerial school, but people kept telling me, in this ministerial school, you've got to meet Reverend Michael Beckwith. You've got to meet him. And the first time I went to his church, I saw what I wanted for South Africa. So I saw blacks, Hispanics, Asians, whites, a multicolored spiritual community, all holding hands, praying together, singing together, worshiping together. And I thought, great, Michael's done it in America, so I can do it in South Africa. He gave me the vision of possibility. I stayed in America for 10 years and finished my training with Reverend Michael. And then I went back to South Africa in 2000 and started my multiracial ministry.
So, well, that's amazing. That's like interesting. You did all of this because your passion was to unite people. And I believe that's just so relevant to what's going on today and what's going on in the world and what's going on in America. So that may have been years ago, but it's just so relevant today. I have a couple more questions. Didn't mean to cut you off, but I want to go over to Carla real quick, specifically because with Right to Influence, your focus is on the government and top people within America and the way they write. How does race play in that? Because sometimes when we look at words in history, it's like, this is the word that was said, but this is what was really meant. So I know you have to be careful about that. Carla, would you care to comment?
Sure. I focus on helping you clarify your thoughts. Race doesn't enter into what I do. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, if you have the message, here's how you communicate it clearly and precisely with precision to make sure it's understood, that it's tailored in terms that the audience will understand, mm-hmm. and so that you're able to pass the baton of your thought to somebody else. That's my focus. It applies certainly to government and businesses, but even more importantly, this is my calling, and I feel it as passionately as our dear Reverend there. I'm enjoying your story, by the way, but this is my calling because you can actually change your life. You can open doors to opportunity that would otherwise have remained closed, but for the fact that you couldn't tell your story. And I've got so many testimonials. Colonel Bass, if it hadn't been for you or for your writing methodology, I wouldn't have been able to. So this truly changes lives. So it's important for corporations and businesses, but I'm really heartened when I'm able to help individuals, help people open those doors.
You said this was your calling. When did you determine that this was your calling? How did you determine it?
I discovered this when I was at Lieutenant Colonel with the squadron. That's where I discovered that powerful writing changes lives. And over the next 15 years, I had so many people, testimonials. They'd stop me in the hallways of the Pentagon and say, if it hadn't been for you, I wouldn't have gotten into officer training school. I wouldn't have gotten the Congressional Fellowship, or I wouldn't have gotten, that's where I learned. And then when I retired, you know, this is in my soul. It's in my soul. When I retired, I had to decide, do you write a book? You turn this into something that everybody can use. If you do, get off your butt. I putzed with it for 5 years. I couldn't stand it anymore. It was, okay, Carly, you either do it or you flush it. And double negative, I could not do it because I knew it had already helped so many people. God gave me this gift. I suck at math, but I excel in writing. And so, you know, Oprah calls this a heart song. And mm-hmm. if you're lucky, you can find your heart song. Well, I've been blessed with two. The first was service to my country. And then out of that came the second heart song, which I call a calling. And that's why I am so passionate about it.
I love your honesty, though. Like, people always ask me, I'm going to have to ask Carla, because you break it down. You give them the truth. Carla said, get off your butt. Those are words to live by. How about you, Samita? Is this your passion, what you do?
This is, you know, I love what I do. Mm-hmm. I have lots of passions. This was my family business that I fell into. And since March 13th, it's been shut down. Mm-hmm. I've chosen. I am the CEO today. It evolved into that over a matter of many years. But I had to make a choice. And when the governor decided to let us open back up as an industry, I still chose to stay closed because mm-hmm. I feel that intimate touch services, it's too soon. Mm-hmm. And it is not safe for someone to, not safe for my team, my artist. It's also not safe for my clients. So mm-hmm. at this point, Ziba Beauty is shut down. You never know, we might have another shutdown for the industry as well, the way things are going. But I felt that it was really important and a responsible thing for me. I absolutely do follow my passions. In everything you do, when you get to know me, as you people that know me know that Samita equals passion. I just wanted to share my thoughts of what came to my mind in listening to each one of you speak. And I want to start with Reverend Stephanie. You know, in terms of like the unifier, I come from Sikhism. I'm a Sikh. And the first word in our scriptures is one. You know, I'm actually wearing the symbol Ekonkar. Those are the first words in the Sikh scriptures, and the first letter is one. And so the oneness, you know, and I think that the great equalizer has been COVID. You know, yes. It has really shown us how connected we are and how much everything is only collective. So, you know, it's just so interesting how life works. And then for Carla, I learned and heard, I like to go to a lot of trade shows, and I like to read, and I'm very avid follower of quotes and things like that. And one of the things that always stood out to me was a description for but, which was that it's not necessarily a negative word, but it is a negator. you know, it negates the sentence that came before it. I love you, but XYZ. You are beautiful, but. And so I was told to replace the word but with and. You know, I'm sorry we lost your luggage and you're going to have to come pick it up instead of however or but. Mm-hmm. And so I try my level best. Those are one of two examples that really changed my mindset in terms of I really try hard not to use the word but and replace it. I don't always succeed, but I try to, like, I just use it but. And I try to replace it with and. And I also try to replace, instead of I have to do something, with the word get. And so I think you as a writer would realize how powerful just the movement of one word can be. Even an inflection, a comma, an emphasis, you know?
Exactly. Two thoughts. The word but can also be a pivoter to something positive. If you deliver the bad news, it also is a way to find that silver lining in the cloud. Yes. So but is not always negative. It's just a pivoter. Yes. Have to, instead of get, and you're right, I value every single word. So when someone needs to say, I have to, I replace that with must. I must do such and such.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I like it. It's just so much. It's so beautiful how words, like the word that is tricky for me, and this word I've been trying to get out of my vocabulary for years, is the word basically. Like I was saying, well, Allison basically organizes homes, and it's like, okay, she doesn't basically organize homes or basically, you know, yeah. She basically organized, you know, it's like, no, she either does or she doesn't. It either is or it isn't, you know? So I don't know why, but I always have the word, the habit of saying basically, Allison. This is a great show.
Allison, I for you, my thought was, I come from countries, I'm Indian of origin, but born in England and brought up in Iran. I moved a lot like you, but countries, not cities and apartments. The America is the, I find it always funny that, you know, most of the countries that I come from don't even have garages, or the concept of garages are rare. It's a luxury. A lot of people don't have cars, and a lot of houses don't have garages. And America is the only country that I know where people park their junk. They park their $50,000, $100,000 cars on the street, and they use
junk in a garage.
Junk. So,
America is very consumerized with stuff, and Amazon is a great delivery tool to give you that stuff. I'm not saying Amazon's bad, it just requires self-control. One of the things that I have, I guess, learned with moving 30 times is everything we have is just stuff. It's not important. One of the first moves I did, a lot of the moves happened before I had my child. And then when I had my child, I really tried to stay in a place longer than a year, so to provide consistency, because my child was under 5 and she's exploring her life and she doesn't know what's going on. And then I have to, you know, yank her up and move her a bunch of places. So I really tried to minimize the moving while she was under 5. Then when she hit 5, then I could explain the moving process. And so I remember one night telling her, well, in so many terms, I was going to be homeless, and we had to get rid of our stuff because my little car only fits so much. And so here she is 5, and she's only known like 1 or 2 houses. And so her little heart was just so innocent and fragile, and, you know, trying to tell a 5-year-old, hey, we're going to be homeless. See this beautiful house we're in? We're going to be homeless in 3 days. Like, I have to purge all this, and I have to find a plan B. And so I remember sitting her down and saying, hey, I know you like all this stuff in this beautiful house that we're in, but we got to move to a smaller place, because I'm thinking we're moving into our car or a shelter or a motel or something to that equivalent. And I go, so I'm going to tell you the best thing about life is the most important thing is in life are you and I. And as long as we're together, everything else can be replaced, rebought, given to us, whatever. So she looks at me with her little eyes, you know, and everything, and she's clutching onto her stuffed animal, and she goes, can Dumbo come with us? And I go, oh, yeah, Dumbo can come with us. And she's all, okay, I'm okay with getting rid of all the other stuff. As long as I have you and Dumbo, I'm good. said from a 5-year-old that she was just mommy and her stuffed animal. And from that point onward, I knew that I was doing a good job raising her and, you know, telling her what's important and everything like that. And so after that move, that was like, I don't know, 8 or 9 moves ago. So, so what happens is when I do a move, I get rid of everything down to the bones, the essentials that we need to live off of, and everything else I just donate. And then we get into our next place. And a lot of times I don't know where we're going because I have problems with my credit. And, you know, people have high, Southern California, you have to make 5 times your income to qualify. And, you know, everything has to be written down. And, you know, what you did 28 years ago pops up on your credit report randomly. So, you know, so I'm always fighting with that. So I never know where I'm going to end up. And so so then once we get into a space, then I spread out our essentials and go, okay, we need a blender. Okay, I need this. Okay, I need that. And then I just go back to the same place I donated everything to and rebuy it. And so then we spread out and we get all of our stuff. And then in every home I set up the same way and whatnot. But I remember but as I go into those homes, they have so much stuff and they're all attached to it. And when I bring up my minimalist idea to them, it's like I have 2 heads. And it's pretty, you know, I know that stuff is important and it has all these family heirloom feelings. And, you know, you met this person when you, people keep the outfits that they met their potential husbands from, like their spouses. A house I organized a couple of days ago, they're moving to Korea. They have the shirts that they wore on their first date. They had to keep them.
I think that's beautiful. That is so beautiful, but only those shirts. I mean, like, you can't keep the shirts, the napkins, the, you know, the paper plate. Like, at least let some of those things go. And one of the things that I've learned, because I've lost everything that I own except for the clothes I had on me at that point. And so it's hard to let things go, and people deal with it in different ways. But you know what? We'll discuss that more in a month when you come back, Allison, and if you, any of you other ladies, if you love to come back, I would love to have you as well, because we have so much to talk about. I didn't get an opportunity to learn more about Reverend Stephanie's journey. We just got that little tidbit of how she started, and I have to find out what happened since then. But since we are coming down to the last few minutes of the show, what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests to speak directly to the audience, everyone who's watching live, as well as everyone who's watching the show in the archives, and just simply let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance. And we're going to start with you, Reverend Stephanie.
Okay, thank you. Let me show you the 2 books I've written. This is called The Misadventures of an Irreverent Reverend. And that's my journey.
I love your outfit.
Yeah, that's my ministerial robe that I graduated in, and I just hoiked it up a bit so you could see my stocking tops. And then here's my latest book, which I didn't get to talk about yet, but it's called The Sex Goddess, Debunking the Mythology of God and Sex. So the 2 big drives in my life have been healing racism and healing sexism. And right now I'm focusing more on working with women. Most women have the feeling, what's wrong with me and who's going to fix it? And that's what I address in my work. So I have got lots of different spiritual techniques to heal the damage that's been done by the patriarchy in our wiring, and to allow women to gain access to their divine inner power, their feminine power.
Would you hold that book up again, please? I loved.
The cover's amazing, hey?
Yes. All it needs now is some henna, but it's, other than that, it's perfect.
Right. So my website is www.timelesstransitions.net. And I'll hand over to the other ladies. Thank you, everyone. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I have as well. Please come back, Reverend Stephanie, because I want to read that book as well as ask some questions. Sumita, what do you have for us?
I just wanted, my message at the moment is that we pivoted the company since we've closed, just to keep the lights on and pay the basic bills. We have been providing essential supplies like gloves and hand sanitizer and masks and things like that to our clients at affordable prices and good quality. It's available on our site, www.zibabeauty.com, Z-I-B-A beauty.com. And we have taken a stand to keep our studios closed until We feel it's safe. We did create a, like you said, a multi-billion dollar industry. We literally created the industry. We started it. Both henna as well as threading. We're very proud of that. And today we take it as a responsibility to make sure that wherever you are, just look to us, look on our site, keep yourself informed and allow us to help guide you to go out there for touch services when we feel it's safe. Even though it's very risky for us to take the stance and it could end up killing our 33-year-old family business, I just feel that, you know, it is a very, very important decision. I can live with the demise of Zeba, but not with the demise of a human being. And so I think it's a very responsible thing to do. And for me, 2020, the word, it was so funny. Allison said that I help them preserve the essentials. And so for us, 2020, the word essential is going to be linked with 2020 forever. And that was the year we launched our essential supplies and our online. We didn't really have a online presence on our website. And today that's how we're surviving. So look to our website, come to zebabeauty.com. You'll see our blog. You'll see all the podcasts that I'm participating in. And you'll also see when we are guiding you to when it's safe to go get touch services again.
Samita, I think that was just so beautiful. I really, really honestly do. It touched me in my heart. It touched me emotionally, specifically when you said that, you know, it could really honestly risk this 33-year-old family business. But I've seen so many of the memes going around and say, be clear, the nation is being opened for economic reasons, not for health reasons. So we really have to understand that and be clear. And so I love how even as a CEO, as an entrepreneur, as a businesswoman, you put the health of the people in front of your profits. So I applaud you for that. Thank you. Carla, what do you have for us?
Dr. Stephanie, great to have your book. I didn't think about that. I have my card. I'm not sure if that's even showing or not. Right to influence, okay?
Yes.
Okay. My website is righttoinfluence.net, N-E-T. I would suggest to people you can take power over your own life by learning how to tell your story better. And my methodology is proven it works, and I would love to help you. The second edition just celebrated its first birthday this week, actually. It has 70 more pages than the first edition. It now includes a chapter on grant writing, the essays for college applications, resumes, elevator speeches, and so, so much more. I provide webinars. I used to give workshops, but those have turned into a thing of the past right now. But I give webinars tailored on your products to your mission. So just visit my webpage, and you can reach me, email at carla@righttoinfluence.net. And I thank you for this opportunity.
You're so welcome. I'm going to have to hop over there to righttoinfluence.net just so I can learn more about grant writing. One of the things that I've been focused on during COVID-19 is how do we get this money? But I think one of the people who can answer that question is my dear friend, Allison Allman. How we get this money, Allison?
I don't know.
Hard work.
I don't know. I didn't qualify for much of the free money, so I've been out just working every day. The best way
I didn't qualify either, so I've been working right along with you.
Well, it's just everything has changed. Everything from all of our goals changed, and so it's all about, you know, it's using however. And must and adjusting and everything. Everything has changed from the past couple of months. But the best way to get in contact with me for any of your organizing dilemmas, I guess, or things that bother you because you sit and stare at it now that you're home. is through my website. It's www.allisonallmond.com. I don't really know what's happening next other than just working on these garages. I have just a lot of different things in the pipeline. And as I get permission to release and talk about more, I will at future shows. There's different things with TV networks happening. And so I'm just having to be quiet and be patient and pivot and help people and kind of just go from there.
I love it. I love to help people. I love the pivot. I love the network. I love all of it. So you know, you got to come back, AskSharifah.com, select be a guest, grab your next seat so we can find out what else is going on with you. But with that said, I want to thank you all. Thank you, beautiful ladies, for joining me today. Thank you for sharing your time, your information, your knowledge, your opinions. You're so vulnerable. And you know what? Please come back because there's so much going on and I would love your input. I especially want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch the show live, as well as everyone who watches the show in the archives. I definitely appreciate your support, but don't just support the show by watching the show. Our guests have a lot of information that I've included in the post. Please visit their website, check them out, see what they do, take advantage of their resources that they're offering you, but also follow them on social media. Follow them on Instagram, Twitter, find out what's going on with their business and stay up to date. Send them a message. And when you send them a message, please be sure to let them know Sharifah Hardy says hi. Until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.